Okay, now we can move on to our substance, and this will also, this, I want to have as our routine with our breaks, like with the start, that we decide when we'll reconvene, and then we reconvene at that time. You know, there's a certain tendency in academic settings for things to kind of drift, and then the time disappears. So this first week is basically setting groundwork for the rest of the semester to kind of chart out the what it even means to talk about Marxism as a theoretical tradition and to give you my way of sketching the parameters of the overall agenda. Does everybody have an outline, by the way? You have the outline for? Okay. So I've already said something about the, so this is the outline for both this class and for Thursdays. We'll just do as much of this as we can today. And because we're not going to be having a separate discussion part this first class because of all the introductory material, feel free to raise your hand to ask questions as I go, and we can build in some discussion even during the lecture. All right, so first of all, what I'm under the Roman numeral 1 prologue, I've said something about the history of the course. I don't think I need to say more about that. Let me now talk about the broadest context for the class, which is the idea of the Marxist tradition. I explain a little bit of this in the syllabus itself, if you read the front matter of the syllabus. The word Marxism, I think, brings with it a deep ambiguity. If you think about evolutionary biology, the only people that call it Darwinism are critics of evolutionary biology. If you're a creationist and you want to treat evolutionary biology as a doctrine, which is to be just juxtaposed to your beliefs, it's a set of beliefs, and you have your beliefs based on the Bible, and they have their beliefs based on Darwin, you call it Darwinism. No evolutionary biologist says that what they are advocates of Darwinism. They recognize Darwin as a founding figure in the history of evolutionary biology. Some of Darwin's ideas have turned out to be incredibly powerful and robust and remain important ideas in current evolutionary biology. But almost none of Darwin's ideas remain important ideas in an untransformed way. Even the kind of foundational idea of natural selection through sexual reproduction, you know, which is about as hardcore to the Darwin's views as possible, even that's gotten modified once we understood genetics and once we understood DNA and once we understood things like genetic drift. I mean, there's all sorts of things that have been modified pretty significantly. And so nobody studying evolutionary biology would say, what we've got to really do is carefully review the texts of Darwin. You know, you should start by reading the evolution of the descent of man and the evolution of species or whatever the title of the book is. No, you don't cite Darwin as a way of arguing a point about evolution. You cite Darwin in the history of science to make a point about Darwin, but not to make a point about evolution. Well, Marxism has this ambiguity in it. By calling it Marxism, by naming it after a person, it seems to suggest that there's some authoritative status to the texts written by a particular person at a particular historical moment. Marxism easily becomes Marxology, the study of Marx, and Marxolatry, you know, the praise of Marx. And that, I think, is a liability. Now, it's a liability that is understandable why it happened. So if we put our sociology of knowledge hats on and ask, well, why is it that this particular body of social theory is so identified with a person and is given the suffix "-ism," identified with his name. Well, the reason is that Marxist theory has functioned in the world as the motivating ideology of social movements and political forces, not just as the theoretical framework for scientific investigation. And the intellectual, what you might think of as the cognitive demands of a revolutionary ideology are very different from the cognitive demands of a scientific theory. They're not the same. They don't function the same psychologically in the way they motivate people. What you want in a good ideology is something that gives people certainty, which gives people a sense that they know what they're doing and they have purposes that are robust and that are not shakable, so that they are prepared to make sacrifices for a long-term struggle for transformation. A good ideology really motivates people and gives them clarity and certainty about what they're doing. That's why religion functions so well as an ideology. So religion functions as a source of deep meaning and spiritual quests, but it also functions as ideology. That is motivating people to action because it gives you certainties. Marxism as ideology gives people answers to every question. I mean, I'm exaggerating things a little here for purposes of making the point. A scientific framework should breed skepticism. Scientific truths are always provisional. They're never certain. They can't be certain. It's part of the scientific method that all propositions, all things we believe we know about the world, are subject to revision. In the history of Marxism, the term revisionism is a term of abuse. It's a way of discrediting an opponent. You say you're a revisionist, it means you're a sellout, right? In the history of Marxism as political movements, when there's these deep and fierce battles between different political factions, and somebody wants to say, we are the true Marxists and you are a revisionist, that is an attack. Now, it shouldn't be an attack in the scientific framework. If somebody says, you know, what I'm doing is revising my earlier beliefs about how this particular genetic mechanism worked because in light of new evidence and research, I was wrong. People celebrate that. They say, gee, that's great. You know, here's a scientist who really pursues knowledge. They figured out some clever experiments to see whether their previous understandings were adequate and discovered they're not, and they have revised them. Well, that's what the whole point of science is. You get richer and deeper and more refined forms of knowledge by constantly being willing to revise what you thought to be the case. That's not how ideology works, though. It's very tough to revise ideologies without the whole thing coming unstuck and people feeling without anchors, without direction. So Marxism has this problem, which is also part of its historical strength. So I think it's both a virtue and a liability. Its historical strength is that it's engaged in the world and it's part of the transformative process that the theory is attempting to understand. Marxism acts in the world as an intellectual force, and it's a scientific framework for analyzing the world, including its own role in the world. Well, that's a pretty messy combination. And I think the way I like to think of it is that cognitively, these two modalities, the ideological and the scientific modality within the Marxist tradition, are kind of at war with each other in your own imagination, in your own cognitive structure. They don't fit comfortably together. In those periods in history where the movement and political force of Marxism is at its most vibrant, you know, at those moments, then this tension becomes clearest, because often when there are political choices to be made, they play themselves out in the form of factions and attacks, and then deciding who is abandoning the true path and who isn't becomes important, you know, becomes salient historically. I, therefore, myself prefer to use the expression the Marxist tradition rather than Marxism. as a way of just talking about this broad tradition of ideas and debate and theory, which I see as extremely valuable for the kinds of questions which I think are important to ask, rather than Marxism, which suggests that it's a doctrine to which one adheres. Now, there are some aspects of this tradition which I think are extremely robust. Very strong evidence, empirical evidence, historical evidence behind them, and they provide powerful and coherent clusters of ideas and arguments to make sense of those empirical, of that empirical material. So part of this tradition, I think, is very robust. Part of it, I think, is pretty shaky. I don't like to think of Marxism as a paradigm where all the pieces fit together in a coherent whole in which it becomes a kind of comprehensive way of exploring every question. Rather, I think of it as a tradition with very powerful ideas, some very robust, some less so, weakly rather than deeply interconnected, so that you can abandon parts of Marxism without exiting the tradition. You can still be asking the same kinds of questions using some of the key concepts to provide good theoretical arguments without buying into everything. But there are Marxists who believe it's all or nothing, you know, so that if you, for example, abandon what's called the labor theory of value, which is one of the components of Marx's own work, if you think that that just isn't compelling, then you've abandoned Marxism and you are no longer, you know, part of that tradition of thought. Whereas I take a much more relaxed view. Taking a more relaxed view also means I've segued into my own relationship to the material here. Taking a more relaxed view means to be completely willing, without embarrassment. So this is speaking to those of you who might feel yourself to be part of the Marxist tradition, to borrow from other theoretical traditions. I see no problem at all, not even any tension between drawing from neoclassical economics, Weberian sociology, feminism, when that's appropriate to solve certain problems. I use in my own work, in certain specific ways, I use game theory, for example. Game theory is a kind of, it's not exactly a theory, it's sort of game models. I use those to explain certain kinds of phenomena that are of concern to the Marxist tradition, how class struggle encounters traps, how collective action encounters difficulties, and what those difficulties and dilemmas are. Well, I think game theory is the best way we have for articulating some of those problems, and therefore I see no reason not to use it. If one wants to, you know, refer to the origins of this theoretical tradition, to Marx's own work, he had no hesitation borrowing from all sorts of theoretical traditions of his era, when they help solve problems. My own relationship to this tradition, then, is I see my work as deeply embedded in the Marxist tradition. I've tried to contribute to reconstructing it. That's sort of my career, has been devoted to reconstructing this tradition in ways that makes it more empirically and theoretically powerful. But I've done so through a constant dialogue with non-Marxist currents of social theory and appropriating bits of that where it seems the best way to go. And that's the spirit with which we'll be exploring lots of things in the course of this semester. many Marxisms. So if Marxism should be thought of as a tradition of theory, naturally one would expect there to be many sub-traditions, many currents, many schools. Some of these are heavily embedded in different political traditions. So there's Marxism-Leninism, there's Maoist Marxism, There's Marxism, Leninism, Mao Zedong thought Marxism. There's Trotskyist Marxism. There's anarcho-Marxism. That's Marxism that's articulated to the anarchist political tradition. There's Marxist feminism. That's sort of the strands of Marxism that have been incorporated within certain feminist political currents. There's even what's called post-Marxism that remains in the Marxist tradition. So some things that are called post-Marxism are exits from the tradition. They become anti-Marxism. But the more recent kinds of post-Marxism of the last quarter century or so are kind of peculiar because they're post-Marxism because they're post-Marxism. But they remain in the Marxist tradition because they're still engaged with the problems of class exploitation, oppression, and the transformation of structures of domination towards an emancipatory alternative. To me, if you're engaged with those kinds of questions and you use those kinds of ideas, that's still part of the Marxist tradition. So there are many Marxisms. This course is not a survey of the many Marxisms. I am not going to occasionally we'll touch on some of these forms of variation, but that's not the purpose of the course. The purpose of the course is for me to try to lay out what I think of are the very best and most interesting and useful and robust ideas in this tradition as they are formulated in their best embodiments. So we will read mostly things that have been written in the last 30 years, very little classic literature. Just occasionally there might be some reading in a few sections that might be from older work. My general feeling is it's an indicator of the failings rather than the success of a theoretical tradition if the very best thing that you could find to read about any given topic was written 150 years ago. So ideally, in a course on Marxist theory, one should not read any Marx. Ideally, if the Marxist tradition is successful as a scientific enterprise, then there should not be anything that is the very best thing to read on a topic that was written 150 years ago. There should be something better. There's plenty of reasons to read Marx. He's a brilliant writer. The historical context makes some of the work just extraordinarily powerful and compelling. I absolutely think the study of the history of ideas is a valuable study. And in the Marxist tradition itself, because so much Marxist work has the character of reinterpretations and commentaries on what Marx said, it may be unavoidable ultimately to, so to speak, read Darwin in order to understand contemporary evolutionary biology. Well, in biology, you don't have to read Darwin to understand contemporary evolutionary biology. But in the Marxist tradition, you probably at some point do really need to engage Marx just because that's the idiom in terms of which people write about contemporary problems. But in this class, we're not going to do much of that. The particular strand of Marxism that my work is associated with is sometimes referred to as analytical Marxism. Analytical Marxism. Some people have called this incorrectly, I think, rational choice Marxism. That's not a correct characterization of the kind of Marxist theory that I have been developing and I work on. Let me just tell you a little bit about my biographical context for this. I think it's kind of interesting. So I was a graduate student in the early 70s. That was the intense period of the Renaissance of Marxist theory after the sort of demise of the Communist Party, Stalinist consensus and lock on Marxism in many Western countries. The late 60s and 70s was this effervescent period where new work was being done. So I was a graduate student in that period, and there was a very vibrant circle of left-wing academics very interdisciplinary. Nobody, when we held our seminars and our various kinds of gatherings, nobody paid any attention whatsoever to disciplinary boundaries. I would say for most of my colleagues that I worked with on these things, I probably didn't even necessarily know what discipline they were in. We just had seminars, which we ran at various universities in the Bay Area, in particular where I was. So we saw ourselves at that time as not consumers of Marxist ideas, but as producers. This was a period when many journals, which are still very active, and some which are not, some which have died, were founded by, and mostly founded by, graduate students and occasionally some young professors, but mostly it was by students. The journal Critical Sociology today, used to be called The Insurgent Sociologist, was founded by graduate students in the early 70s. The journal Politics and Society, I'm on the editorial board, was founded at the same time, also entirely by graduate students at the time. I was most involved in a journal called Capitalist State, which was a Marxist journal around problems of the theories of the state. It was founded in the Bay Area. There was a capitalist state collective that was organized in Madison, and another one in Bielefeld, Germany. And I think those were the three main ones. I was a graduate student at Berkeley. There was a Madison Capital State Collective. There were graduate students here who were, this is before computers, we'd send papers back and forth. Roger Friedland and Jusping Anderson, both well-known professors, were graduate students here. They wrote a paper. They sent it to the Bay Area Capital State Collective. I sent them 20 pages of comments and criticisms of it. They asked me to be a co-author of the paper and incorporate all my criticisms into the paper, so we wrote this paper together. That's how I ended up here in Madison. The graduate students here recruited me to come to Madison as an assistant professor. So this was actually the only place I applied to. You know, because they basically told the faculty here, you got to recruit Eric, right? He's got to come here and join us. And we had this network that was already producing stuff. So we saw ourselves, you know, there's a certain arrogance to this too. We saw ourselves as not consumers of these ideas, but as producers of them, right from the start. We were publishing like crazy as graduate students, in these offbeat places mostly. But you cut your teeth on how to write articles and how to publish things and how to speak to the world rather than just speak to your professors by seeing that everything you did needed to have a public audience. That was the point of it. Well, that's in the early 70s when I did that, the hot, theoretically exciting terrain for arguing about these things was within Marxism, came especially from France. Louis Althusser and Nikos Poulantzas in particular were two French writers, Althusser a philosopher, Poulantzas more of a sociologist, writing about various themes. Althusser mostly on writing about classical texts, Poulantzas writing about the state and real historical contexts. I happened to be fluent in French, which was just an accident of the language I studied in high school, and having spent some time in Paris at one point. And so I was able to read Poulantzas in particular before it was translated into English. And so in those early days in the 1970s when I was trying to rethink Marxist ideas and did it in this intense dialogue with students at Berkeley and then writing jointly with people here in Madison, with students in Madison, I was the person who would be bringing the French structuralist, Marxist, Poulantzian perspective to bear on these discussions and then to reconstruct them, to push them forward. And that's really the context in which my initial work on social class emerged. You'll be reading some of that in a few weeks. You won't read anything from that period, but you'll be reading stuff that grew out of that earlier period. Then I came here, and in 1978, Jerry Cohen, a philosopher at Oxford, wrote an extraordinary book called Karl Marx's Theory of History of Defense, which we'll read it. That's the book we'll read at the end of the semester when you're all seasoned. And you'll be able to just grab that book and you'll say, wow, this is really cool. It does belong at the beginning because it kind of sets a stage, but at any rate. So I read that book. If you want the kind of finely grained biographical detail, my wife and I adopted a newborn baby in the summer of 1979. She was born in Costa Rica, and I went down to take custody and was in Costa Rica for 10 weeks, and my wife joined me after a week. So I was there with this newborn baby and Jerry Cohen's book, right, in the summer of 1979. And I wrote a critique of it, you know, an engaged criticism. It wasn't an attack. It was trying to reformulate some of his ideas. That summer, which was then published in New Left Review, Jerry Cohen read the paper, thought it was really interesting, and invited me to come to a meeting the following year, so this would have been in September of 1980, in London, to discuss various related matters. That meeting turned into what has now been an over 30-year-old annual meeting of about 10 or 12 scholars from different disciplines that in the early 80s decided to call itself the NBSMG, the No Bullshit Marxism Group. It subsequently became known as the Analytical Marxism Group. They published a collection of essays that came out of our annual meetings in the 1980s called Analytical Marxism. And now, in a much lamer way, it's called the September Group. It has mostly met in September. That's the intellectual setting in which my ideas have been most deeply shaped and forged. That's the cast of characters who I argue with and who are sitting behind me when I'm writing something and saying, come on, I can't defend that argument. Or in other ways, their shadows, their shades, you know, the ghosts. Jerry Cohen died a few years ago, but he's still present. He's there looking over my shoulder when I was writing Envisioning Real Utopias and telling me, you really have to straighten out that argument. It's not clear enough yet. Analytical Marxism, then, is a particular way of thinking about this enterprise. The emphasis, there's a couple of readings about that, I think, for this first week. The emphasis is on clarity. That's where the no bullshit, part of the no bullshit stuff, is that you really make it clear what you're saying. One way to think about it is this way. This may seem ironic or something. You should write in ways that make it as easy as possible for people to criticize you, not as difficult. You want your work to be criticized because you know you can't have gotten everything right. It's the height of arrogance to imagine that you write something that is so perfect, that is so complete, that has answered every question you're addressing so totally that there's no way it could be made better. Well, if your commitment is to making things better, you want to make it easy for people to say, you know, this is really interesting, but why don't you think about this? Well, they can't get to that point unless it's clear. And that's this idea. You should write in such a way that it's easy for people to know why they disagree with you. Now, that doesn't mean you want to make yourself open to stupid criticism by writing stupid things. You know, it's easy to write things that need improvement because they're very badly written. The ideas are very badly thought through. No, that's not the point, obviously. You really want your work to be part of an ongoing dialogue that pushes the issues forward, not that creates closure. That's a tough thing to really, really grasp. And it's a way, you know, I know it's tough for students because it means that you're constantly making yourself vulnerable. People want closure. They want to be able to say, I've nailed this. Come on, world. You can't possibly. No. That's a recipe for never publishing anything also. It's a recipe for being this kind of, there's a certain kind of iconic, brilliant graduate student and academic who never publishes anything because they're perfectionists. That is, they recognize the flaws of their own work, and until they can eliminate the flaws, they won't publish it, because if there's a flaw, then somebody might criticize it. Well, that, to me, is just a completely self-destructive way of thinking about, an unproductive way of thinking about intellectual activity. I'm rambling here a little bit. It's an unproductive way of thinking about intellectual activity, because imagine if that's the way you thought about a conversation. I'm not going to say something in a conversation unless there's no response that somebody could give. You'd be a really boring conversationalist. You should think of intellectual work as a dialogue which should go somewhere. And to go somewhere, it needs to be clear. Well, that's, I think, the hallmark of the analytical Marxist way of doing Marxism, is to really emphasize clarity, making all definitions of concepts explicit, laying bare the assumptions, the parts of your theory which you're just going to take as premises, making that really clear, and making the connections between concepts transparent. It's really transparency and clarity. That's at the heart of it. Well, that's the kind of Marxism I am engaged in, and that's the kind of Marxism which mostly will be embodied in the reading. So this is, as I said, it's not a review. The course is not a review of all the different available strands of Marxism. There is a certain style of what's sometimes called Hegelian Marxism, of which there will be almost no, there may be no real readings from that tradition in the course. There may be some that have a little bit of that flavor. And that's because I find it extremely obscure and without clear definitions, without explicit discussion of the mechanisms. When Marxists invoke dialectical reasoning as some kind of meta-theoretical, abstract way of thinking about things, without explaining what that means, without giving it any clear specification of the mechanisms involved, then I find it most of the time unhelpful. And that kind of reading will not be present in the course. It's also the case in the class that a lot of the readings are things that I've written. Now, this is always a bit of an awkward thing for a professor to do. You know, I've had a pretty long career at this point. I've been at Wisconsin for 37 years. I've been publishing now for over 40 years. I publish stuff as a graduate student. And I have worked relentlessly on lots of the topics in this class. So it's kind of easy for me to, for some of the topics, particularly the topics around class, to feel not in a kind of narcissistic, arrogant manner to think that the best thing that I could assign are things that I've written. But it certainly is the case that the thing which represents my views on the matter are things that I have written. So there's a fairly significant dose of readings from me. Occasionally I have students in this class who get really annoyed at that by the end of the semester. I hope you'll be at least a little forgiving, even if you find it a little annoying that you read more of me than you think might be desirable. Point five on the prologue, learning the language of Marxism. Throughout this course, we're going to be moving around a variety of different kinds of analyses. We'll have conceptual discussions about the core categories that we use to build social theories. We'll have theoretical discussions about how to link those categories together in various kinds of explanations. We will have empirical and historical discussions around a range of very specific problems. And from time to time, we'll have some discussions of a more philosophical character, about the nature of knowledge, about the kind of what one might call the meta theory, the theory of the theory, the kind of foundational principles that drive our arguments. A lot of our attention will be focused on concepts, giving very clear definitions. Now, I probably spend in my own work more time worrying about how to define things than almost any other sociologist I know. Some people have criticized me for this. Theda Skocpol, who some of you, the seasoned sociologist here will know who she is. She's a well-known historical comparative sociologist. She once accused me of packing my bags for a trip I never take. And that's the idea that I spend all my time worrying about how to define class, but I never get on with the business of studying anything using the concept of class. I'm just preoccupied with the problem of how do we define the concept of the middle class in the context of a Marxian class framework. Right. Well, there's, as in any such accusation, there's at least a kernel of truth in it. I don't think it's quite a fair accusation, and it's probably less fair now than when she made it. This was in the early 80s when I was even more preoccupied with getting really nailing down the definitions of what do we mean by exploitation, what do we mean by class, what exactly defines the state as a particular kind of social organization. So I was really preoccupied with definitions, a bit less so now, but it's still true. In Envisioning Real Utopias, if you've read some of that, you'll see a lot of passages that are basically saying, okay, here's the concepts we're going to use, here's how I'm going to define them, here's the defense of that definition. Well, for good or ill, I've felt that a lot of confusion in social theory comes from badly defined concepts. You have vaguely defined concepts that could mean all sorts of different things. Different people use the same words to mean very different things. And so when people get into debates, they think they're debating about the same object, but they're not. They're talking past each other. And they're talking past each other, at least in part because they're using words to mean different things. And the way you get that sorted out is by being really clear about your definitions. So we will, characteristically in this course, begin each section with a kind of dictionary discussion. You know, here's the words we're going to need to understand class. Here's the words we're going to need to understand ideology. Here's the words we're going to need to understand the state. And here's the definitions I propose to give coherence to our vocabulary. So it's really learning the language of Marxism, of the Marxist tradition. As in any language course, those of you, I'm sure all of you have taken language courses at various times. Some of you are living a language course in your daily life. You know that it's always really tough at the beginning because dictionaries have this peculiar quality that every word is defined in terms of other words. And it's only after you've read the whole dictionary that you can read the dictionary. Right? You have to know the language before you can read the dictionary. So the way this works then in a course like this is that the things at the beginning of the course become clearer as you go on, not because we revisit those topics necessarily, but because the real shades of meaning and the inner structure of meanings of concepts becomes clearer as they become more and more embedded in a whole matrix of concepts. That's how words get their meaning, not from their isolated characteristics, but from their embeddedness. And that's especially true for the kind of abstract ideas that we'll be talking about. You know, a word that identifies a concrete object, a cow, you can, in a dictionary, draw a picture of it and put the word cow under it. That does pretty much the whole job, or much of the job of telling you what the word means. Well, you can't do that for class. You can't draw a picture of it. You can't do that for the state. And that's why these concepts will become clearer as we go along. The only advice I can give you is, like in any language course, one of the keys is patience, just to tolerate a certain amount of ambiguity And then things clarify as the interconnections become developed in the course of the course. All right, that's the prologue. Any questions or thoughts or reactions to any of those? I know it's this is also going to illustrate a feature of our class together. It's always a kind of lame move by a professor to talk for 15 minutes and say any questions, right? It's really a lousy way to get any discussion. Because what you're doing then is you've done something and then you say, okay, does anybody want to be put on the spot now to ask a question? You know, it's just not the way to get a good discussion. You know this. You've all been in seminars. You know how things go. The best way for questions to emerge is organically from my saying something and you having a thought and wanting to, interrogate something I've said or to engage in dialogue. So I will periodically, like I just did, say, are there any questions? You should hear that not in the spirit of, okay, does anybody want to be put on the spot by raising their hand? Or does anybody want to show off, right? That's, for some of you, that would be the fear. I'm going to be a show off if I raise my hand. No, the idea is just an invitation, as if we were sitting over coffee, for you to now know that you're not interrupting me. Okay, so does anybody want to be put on the spot and show off? Yeah.
I was thinking with your analogy with Darwin and Marx that do you think that there will be, is it just science fiction to think that there might be a time when there's something that's analogous to DNA where you have mechanisms of social evolution, or is that like science fiction? What I'm thinking of is like GIS systems, where if you know the variance in regions, that you can maybe predict what changes in that region would change the social structure. You know, mainly from anthropology, they use a lot of GIS, the geographic information systems.
Right.
They're starting to use it in sociology some too. Is that sort of an analogy to that, or not really?
So we will at the in this last block of the course we'll be discussing the theory of history and the particular way that Marx attempted to build and in the Marxist tradition a broad theory of history, which is an attempt at creating a theory of the history of the future. The purpose of a theory of history in Marxism is not actually to explain the past, it's to explain the future, and it is thought to be predictive in this sense that to be predictive. Now, the question is whether or not that's a plausible enterprise. Is there any likelihood that we could actually develop a plausible theory of the future that extends beyond the very near future? And I don't think it's plausible. I think that that's not a plausible theoretical enterprise, and it's the part of the Marxist tradition which is ultimately the weakest and which unfortunately is of absolutely pivotal importance for certain kinds of theoretical arguments. I don't think that means one has to abandon the Marxist tradition. I just think that the effort at a theory of history is unlikely to be the case, is unlikely to be successful. And the problem with it is that the kind of theory of history that Marx was trying to create was one that would tell us what qualitatively different forms of society will emerge in the future, given the dynamics of the present. That's way different from what you're talking about with the kind of big data sets. And those are talking about what kinds of trends emerge within fixed parameters. The equations have to remain constant, and then you can understand the development of changes within those equations. But so to speak, if what you're really trying to understand about the future is an entirely different set of equations that will emerge, and particularly in which it's just not plausible that they'll emerge without human intention, without purpose. That is, the kind of future to capitalism that Marxists envision is one that human beings are going to have to create through their collective struggles. Well, it's just not plausible, I think, to imagine an evolutionary type theory that would enable you to make that kind of extrapolation into the future. But that's the puzzles around that task, which are pretty fundamental and super interesting. I mean, the intellectual challenge is fantastic. And the classical Marxist attempt at solving it is just stunning in its intellectual architecture. It's just not plausible, I think. And that's what we'll be talking about the last block of the class. Yeah.
So are most people that have contributed to the analytical Marxist tradition located in the US and or Europe? And have you tried to be in conversation with theorists from Latin America or Africa?
Yeah.
And if not, what do you think the implications of that are?
Yeah, so there's the people who were at the core of developing this self-consciously were European and American. They were very diverse in terms of disciplinary heritage, you know, bases, the philosophy, economics, history, sociology, political science. But they were definitely, they weren't just European and North American, they were white and they were male, right? I mean, it was for many years a very deep source of embarrassment to the group, because most of the guys in this group are deeply committed feminists in terms of both their personal practices and the roles they play in their institutions, right? Absolutely, you know, not defending white male supremacy in any way, but this style of interaction and the intellectual traditions that this was rooted in were such that the people who were engaged in these kinds of questions just turned out to be mostly, well, for a while it was all male. Now there are a couple of women who are part of this group now in the last 15 years. So, you know, and some of them were students of Jerry Cohen. So, you know, you kind of transform the world through your own practices in that way. Now, so that's the first point. Now, it's resonated quite well with some currents in Latin America, not in Africa, as far as I know. I can't think of the African thinkers who have embraced this way of doing things. But in Latin America, in Brazil and Argentina, when I go there, there are people. My work has been translated. I get bigger audiences in Latin America when I give a guest lecture than I do in the U.S. I mean, I'm better known there as a Marxist who's trying to rebuild the tradition in a way that seems useful than in the U.S. So in the U.S., if I give a visiting lecture at a university, I feel really great if 50 people show up. That's a big audience. When I was in Santiago, Chile, there were 600 people who showed up for a lecture I gave. I just couldn't believe it. You know, and they all had this idea that I was this iconic figure. You know, it's just kind of totally, it did not compute, right, exactly what was going on. I mean, there's historical reasons for that. Some of my work was translated into Spanish very early on at a time when Marxist theory was very vibrant in Latin America as well, and it's been incorporated into the general intellectual life, at least in some places.
I just want to follow the question. I mean, I feel that it's very interesting that, you know, the works are being translated. I mean, in any kind of language, some like developing countries, and I read the book, and I think, you know, you ask for the clarity, and you use a lot of data that you've been collected for, over decades, to create this kind of anomalies to get your conclusion, but there are places in the world that the data is not possible, you know, it's not kind of reliable for you to get this kind of analysis, like, you know, like China, like India. Do you still think the serrated framework of your work could be applied to this effort?
Yeah, I think so. And in China, I've lectured quite a bit in China. I mean, quite a bit. I've been to 10 universities. That's quite a bit by my standards in China. And And a number of my things have been translated into Chinese. Envisioning World Utopias is being translated right now. It should be out next year, I think. And people in China were engaged in very lively discussions about its relevance, and they could see how many of these ideas were quite relevant to particular situations. Of course, you have to adapt it. It's not that my writing, and particularly my empirical writing, wouldn't be directly just transferable, but the way of approaching the problems people felt resonated, at least the people who came to my seminars when I was visiting in China. Okay, let's move on to discuss this idea of emancipatory social science. I see the Marxist tradition as probably the strongest theoretical tradition within a broader intellectual space. In the broader intellectual space, I currently call emancipatory social science. You know, you have to have labels for things, and that seems to be as good a generic umbrella term for any. There are different currents within emancipatory social science. Feminism would be another current within emancipatory science, social science. Certainly critical race theory would be part of emancipatory social science. Some strands of things like world systems theory and globalization theories, which are not explicitly Marxist, would also be part of an emancipatory social science, although many of those currents really are threads within the more broadly understood Marxist tradition. So what I'd like to do, first of all, is discuss this broad idea of emancipatory social science and then hone in on the Marxian form of emancipatory social science. One way I've approached this more recently, so I think I talk a little bit about this. One of the readings that was assigned was the paper in the American Sociological Review that came out of my presidential address when I was president of the ASA. It's the paper called Transforming Capitalism Through Real Is it Transforming or Transcending Capitalism? I forget what the title is. Transforming Capitalism Through Real Utopias. I think I talk about this a little, I frame it a little bit in this way there, although I don't talk about Marxism so much directly in that paper. Anyway, I think we can, for emancipatory social science in general, the expression emancipatory social science is actually a kind of shorthand for a more cumbersome expression, which is just overloaded with highfalutin words. It should be called critical emancipatory social science. But since all emancipatory social science has to be a form of critical theory, but not all critical theory is emancipatory, I'm just going to call it emancipatory social science. So there are two foundational propositions which I think underlie this. When you say them, they sound almost trivial in a way. How could anybody disagree with this? But I think they're not trivial. And they are important to articulate even if they were trivial, but they're not. The first one is this. This I would call, and I wrote, normally in my outlines, I don't write out any details of the lecture, just the headings. But occasionally when I'm trying to define something, I'll give you the actual definition in your notes so you have it. So first, there's what I would call the foundational proposition of a critical social science, which is this: many forms of human suffering and many deficits in human flourishing are the result of existing institutions and social structures. If you disagree with that, if you do not believe that many forms of human suffering and many deficits in flourishing are the result of the way the world is organized socially, if you were to disagree with that, then you would not be a critical social scientist. You could not be engaged in the practice of criticizing the world as it is. The only reason to criticize the world as it is because you think it does harm. Otherwise, what's the point? So this is the kind of foundational empirical claim. It's a claim about how the world is, that the world as it is creates many forms of human suffering and deficits in human flourishing. Now, it doesn't, that's a very abstract statement. It doesn't say what it is about the world. It doesn't say where the flaws are. You can be a Christian conservative and believe this, right? You can believe that it's the dissolution of the family, it's the promiscuous welfare state, it's Hollywood cultural practices that are causing all the damage. Well, that's still a claim that human suffering and deficits in human flourishing are not the result of nature. They're not the result of psychological failings. They're not the result of God. They're the result of the way our institutions are organized. That's the most abstract claim of critical social science. The foundational claim of an emancipatory social science is transforming those institutions and structures has the potential to reduce human suffering and expand the possibilities for human flourishing. Now, that claim might seem to be simply a corollary of the first claim. If you believe existing institutions cause harms, then doesn't it logically follow that transforming those institutions has the potential to reduce harms? Well, it turns out, I think, that it is not a corollary, even though it has the flavor of a corollary. Corollary just means it logically follows from the previous statement. The reason, or corollary, there's two different ways of, just so you're, particularly for the non-English speakers, so your ears get tuned in. Corollary and corollary, I think corollary is the way they say it in Britain and corollary is the way they say it here. And since I've been educated in both places, I sometimes don't remember which, you don't hear the word that much, right? So you don't remember exactly which side of the Atlantic says it which way. Okay. The reason it's not simply a logical derivation is it's always possible that while existing institutions create harms, efforts to make things better only make things worse. The cure can be worse than the disease. You know, it's just always possible that although it is true that the existing structures cause harms, transforming those structures is just going to create havoc. That there can be even worse harms caused by the process of transformation. And therefore, it is not true that transforming those institutions would reduce harms. Transforming the institutions would just increase harms because the cure is worse than the disease. Now, it's therefore a fantasy, not a social science. It would be a utopia. It would be a foundational claim of emancipatory utopianism that transforming those institutions would make things better, but not of emancipatory social science, because the way the world works, unfortunately, is that the negative effects of transformation will undo whatever positive effects. This is essentially the claim of the famous right-wing libertarian economist Hayek, Friedrich von Hayek. You can think of this as kind of Hayek's law, which is that the negative unintended consequences of social change are always bigger than the positive intended consequences. And that the bigger the change, the bigger the negative intended consequences. Well, if you believe that, then you don't believe that emancipation is possible, because any effort at changing institutions is going to disrupt the fragile fabric of social life in ways that make life worse for people. Well, an emancipatory social science rejects that pessimism. Now, the reason why not all critical theorists are emancipatory theorists is because some critical theorists are very gloomy and pessimistic. They actually believe that we're locked into a dismal world and there's nothing we can do about it because efforts at transforming will always come to naught. That's the kind of spirit. They may not say it so explicitly as that. An emancipatory social science is an optimistic social science. It believes in the possibility of improvement. And to use the old Enlightenment kind of language, it believes in the possibility of progress. In its strongest forms, it believes in the inevitability of progress. That's an even stronger version. All that's really required is a belief in the possibility. Now, the Marxian variant, then, of these claims adds content to these very abstract formulations. Because the foundational claim of critical social science doesn't say anything about where what's doing the damage. Right. And the foundational claim of emancipatory social science says nothing about what needs transforming. It just says, in this super abstract way, that social institutions that causes the damage and social institutions that have to be transformed in this very abstract initial formulation. The Marxian invariant sticks its neck out and makes a substantive claim about the source of harm. The foundational critical thesis of Marxism is many forms of human suffering and many deficits in human flourishing are the result of the class structure and dynamics of capitalism. It identifies a source of harm. And the foundational emancipatory thesis is transcending capitalism by creating a democratic egalitarian political economy has the potential to reduce human suffering and expand the possibilities for human flourishing. Framed in this way, the core of Marxism, what really anchors the whole account, is a particular analysis of capitalism and how it works, and an argument about its transformation. The critical moment is capitalism, by virtue of its class structure on the one hand and its dynamics on the other, we'll discuss what all that means, you know, later. By virtue of those features of capitalism, creates unnecessary forms of human suffering and unnecessary deficits in flourishing, which could be remedied, and that's the emancipatory element, through an appropriate transformation of the class structure and those dynamics, which I'm referring to here in a very general way as transcending capitalism by creating a democratic egalitarian alternative. Those two claims really animate, I think, the most robust core of the Marxist tradition. And if you rejected those claims, it's not that therefore no ideas from Marxism would, you wouldn't have to reject every idea in Marxism. You could still hold to some of the things we'll be talking about. But if you really rejected, if you really felt that human suffering and deficits and flourishing are not the result of class structure and dynamics of capitalism, they're the result of industrialism, for example. So an alternative view is that it's industrialization that causes the problems, not the distinctively capitalist form of industrialization. Or it's modernity that causes the problems, not capitalism. Or if you believe that while it is true that in the course of capitalism development there is a lot of human suffering and deficits to flourishing, the further development of capitalism is going to solve these problems. If you believe that, that's the sort of neoliberal view. That it's not so that although it is true that in the course of capitalism one of the byproducts of capitalist development is suffering and deficits of flourishing, nevertheless, the solution is more capitalism. It's the problem is that capitalism hasn't done all of its work yet. That in the process of its development, it causes harms, but it's those are just temporary harms as byproducts to development, and more what we need is more capitalism. Well, that's the kind of neoliberal diagnosis. Okay. I think we should stop here. Technically this class ends at 10 to 12, you know, just in terms of the way they, and it depends upon whether anyone has a class at, I think 5 after 12 is the next slot on the Tuesday, Thursday. So does anybody in the class have something instantly after?
I work at 12, just a reminder.
Oh, okay, so that's all right.
But it's very close.
Yeah, but nobody has a
12.
Okay. I mean, I think in ordinary clock time rather than the academic hour, you know, which starts at weird times and ends at weird times. So, but I won't dribble over. We'll stop at whatever the natural break point. And since normally we won't be lecturing at this point, we'll be just discussing. We'll stop a few minutes before 12 so people can get to it. All right. I will be next door at 8:30 on Thursday. And if anybody wants to come earlier, just send me an email by Wednesday night so I'll know to get there by 8. Okay? Oh, the mentoring. Oh, absolutely. Okay. Let's all the graduate students stand up. Okay, so we got 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8. And undergraduates, we got 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8. Okay, this is perfect. So, he's a graduate student. Okay, so we will, he'll just join, one group will have two graduate students and one undergraduate. Okay, so you guys count, graduate students count off in this direction. 1.
Okay, 1.
2.
3.
5. 4.
4.
5.
1.
No, no.
1, 2.
No, you, 5, 6. Oh.
7.
8. Okay, and you're not, you're a grad student, right?
Yes.
So you're 9.
Okay, I'm
9. Okay, let's start over. 1.
I'm sorry.
Start over. I mean, graduate students stand up, and the graduate students count off.
1.
2.
3.
4.
5. 6.
7. 8. 9.
Okay, now the undergraduates count off.
1.
2.
3. 4.
5.
6.
7.
8.
Okay, so we have one. So you will join one of the other groups and have one group of two grad students and one undergraduate.
Okay.
Okay. Okay. So the two ones. You go to your one. You go to your two.
How's it going?
You go to
Lauren.
Each of you. Go meet.
Sadie.
Sadie. All right.
So go meet and exchange info.
Yeah.
All right.